Welcome to Friday, and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review, where we take an hour and figure out what mattered from this week and why. I'm Bill Radke, your host, and we're with Mike McGinn, former Seattle mayor. Hiya, Mike.
Hi, glad to be here.
Do you mean it?
I love to be here.
Awesome.
Is that better?
Yes. He hosts a podcast called You, Me, Us Now. Also with us is Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Joni?
How you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
And what a Friday.
What a Friday it is.
Mm-hmm.
And we're happy to have Melanie McFarlane, Seattle TV writer. You can find her stuff at mctelevisionblog.com. Welcome.
Welcome to you.
Nice to see
Friday.
You again, Melanie. So here's our top story from this week. It starts with a question, which is, how are we going to make Seattle a more affordable place to rent a home? There's an idea out now to cut back on Airbnb rentals, VRBOs. This is where you rent out your room, your home to somebody visiting here for a few days or weeks. Those are rentals that are not going to people who live here, which means less supply of housing. Theoretically, that means higher rental prices. So that's the case in favor of this city council idea to limit short-term rentals. But I talked with somebody who owns and rents out vacation properties in Seattle. Michelle Aquavella says, the city's going to take away my livelihood?
This is a business that I have put my blood, sweat, and tears into, literally, over the last 13 years when I started it. And I'm not the only vacation rental property manager, and we employ people. We're looking at a loss of over 100 jobs to what Tim Burgess's office is estimating, and I think it's even a high estimate that there would be 300 housing units added to the long-term rental inventory.
300 housing units. So she's saying not only are short-term rentals a drop in the bucket of the rental market, but it's not fair to torpedo her local small business and her right to use her properties. Melanie, is this Seattle proposal unfair to people who rent out their places?
You know, as someone who does not, this is not in the situation, I am an Airbnb customer.
You are?
Oh, yeah. When I go to
right
other
now?
Cities. Yes, that's I've been just bouncing between Airbnbs. So it's a great model for the consumer. However, if it is just a drop in the bucket, my thought is, okay, so if we do put these limits on it, then what does this mean overall in terms of rents? Even rents that are not not short term are still hugely unaffordable for a lot of people and pushing a lot of people out of town. So I think this is one of those things where it's a teeny tiny attempt to put a Band-Aid on a very large gaping wound.
But it's still a Band-Aid and better than nothing.
I don't know that it's necessarily better. Like I said, I'm not quite sure that this is the solution.
Uh-huh.
It's like I said, it's great for the consumer, but in terms, I think we're looking at this problem in the wrong way.
Because we need to have more affordable housing.
We need to have generally more affordable housing, more rental, and more some sort of idea of a certain percentage of long-term rentals dedicated to a certain amount of rent control and a certain amount of getting, you know, allowing people who can't afford regular, you know, long-term housing, giving them a chance to actually live here.
Former Mayor Mike McGinn, would you have cracked down on Airbnb-type rentals as a way to lower rent prices?
You know, it's fascinating watching this because they're trying to walk a tightrope between allowing the occasional rental of a property and ban somehow long-term rentals of properties. And
let me spell that out for listeners who aren't into the details. You could rent out a property for only up to 90 nights per year unless you own the property and live in it. You can still rent your house's basement as much as you want. And the city's sponsors say they're going to focus on commercial operators who rent multiple properties year-round.
And I get the instinct. We need more units out there in the rental housing market. But again, 300 units. I mean, I think the city council in the last 2 years has blocked for more than 300 new units. Mm. I mean, they have a really simple solution in front of them, which is liberalize the rules for backyard cottages, you know, liberalize the rules for
mother-in-law
apartments.
But they're
not
doing one of these exclusively. They are also liberalizing the rules for backyard
well,
cottages.
One can hope for that. But what we know is that over the last 2 years, they've actually reduced the number of you know, they restricted the number of the micro apartments that were coming out in response to neighborhood concerns. They restricted the amount of small lot development in the city. The fact is, the last 2 years, the city council has removed far more than 300 new units, potential new units from the marketplace. So, and it's a typical, hey, we'll manage the economy from above with very detailed rules that'll hit the sweet spot. And, you know, the city council just isn't very good at that.
Mm, that's the question, right? Joni, is it worth the cost? Because this is a this would cost people who earn money by renting out homes. There's the cost of visitors to Seattle who'd like a place to stay for a week. It costs the city something to enforce new rules. Would this, do you think, lower rental prices so much, though, that it's worth those costs?
Well, not so much, though. My first reaction to this thing was, oh, my gosh, it's too much nanny government getting their hands in, preventing the person who we heard at the top of the hour from doing, you know, a reasonable business. But the more I thought of it, and both of you touched on this, as soon as we get freaked out that we don't have enough housing, we fire up the measures to the voters and ask the voters and the city to create more housing stock. So the city does have an interest in this. Now, what does that interest look like? I'm not sure these are the exact rules that we need. This does remind me in some ways of the fight over Uber and Lyft. It's a new kind of business. We have to respond. I will say that, you know, once you change a residence from a residence to a business, it's going to be different. It's going to feel different. Your neighborhood's going to feel different because it's no longer a residence. So I think the city has an interest. I think they should do what they do best is do these big, huge task forces, invite everyone in, you know, to Safeco Field or something larger and discuss it and come up with some rules that make sense that balance the interests. I was at Civic Cocktail, oddly enough, the other night, and someone came up to me and was talking about West Seattle. And I don't have any way to verify this, but this is interesting that a lot of the properties in West Seattle, supposedly, I don't have a number, are being bought up by folks who are trying to bid this up and rent them out short term. I mean, that's not good housing policy. And if
what do you mean? Nobody wants to bid up something they want to buy.
What I mean is they buy it. Uh-huh. The person who lives there can't afford to stay anymore because of various reasons. And so then that then becomes hot rental property in short-term rentals. Mm. And so that is forcing people out. That's not our value. We want to do something about this. So in my convoluted answer is, how about it?
Well, help me understand, Mike McGinn, you used to run the place.
I had some help.
Yeah,
I had some
fair
help,
enough.
You know,
some say he ran the place.
Well, one of your
Tony
helpers.
Tony wouldn't give me that.
City Council Member Tim Burgess said the city could put 300 homes, if this rule went through, we could put 300 homes back on the long-term rental housing market. And that could save $70 million that it would cost to build 300 new units of housing. Except developers pay the cost of building the units, and they get paid back by the buyers who get paid back by the renters. So how does this save the city anywhere near $70 million?
And I think this is actually a place where Joni and I might have some agreement. You know, we are we are going to the voters and asking for a lot of money to produce housing. But we could also go to, you know, the private sector and make it a little easier for them to build a little more, too. And that doesn't cost us money, as opposed to when we build affordable housing. Now, you have to do both. I want to be really clear about that. There's this false dichotomy in this city.
Yes, I agree with that.
About, right. You know, is it supply or is it subsidized housing? The answer is both, obviously, because the private marketplace isn't going to build housing for very low-income people. But if you can, I mean, in my neighborhood, I walk around, and if you mapped it, there are duplexes and triplexes. There are old corner stores in single-family neighborhoods throughout the city that you couldn't rebuild today because we've downzoned those areas. But I don't think they ruined the neighborhood. They're beautiful neighborhoods that oftentimes, you know, we used to do this as a city. Make it a little bit easier for people to provide housing. And I think if when you look at the Airbnb, absolutely regulate for health and safety. You know, they should pay taxes like hotel rooms or B&Bs, whatever the bed and breakfast, whatever the right.
Some of that is in the legislation to begin doing.
And some of that.
Yeah, if you rent out part of a home that you live in, now you have to get a city license says you've got liability insurance, health and safety.
There is some level playing field between people who provide housing for people coming to town. But you know, there are people who come to town for a few weeks at a time. Maybe they're taking I saw in one article they're taking a training course for nurses. You know, do we really expect them to live downtown, or why not find something that's in the neighborhood that they want that feels more like a home, that might be less expensive, and it puts, you know, gives some new economic opportunity on a small scale. You know, so much of capitalism is on this, in growth and development, is on this really huge scale. How about letting the little guy, so to speak, make a few bucks on the side with something they love?
I'm agreeing with part of that. I think that if they really do task force this in the right way, they could come to a happy medium of where they are letting people rent out, make some money. Of course, that makes sense. But many other cities are finding that if you just let it go willy-nilly, that it ends up raising the prices of rent. And that's something we have to look at a bunch of different things to fix.
Right. It's 300 homes now, but...
But what's the future? Yeah. This is growing like crazy. And so there are future homes that sounds like a nothing number. But there are future numbers that are coming, and I think we should get a grip on it like other cities are doing.
Whether we regulate short-term rentals this way or not, am I hearing all three of you say that you want developers to be able to build higher, and you want more little hotels in neighborhoods and more mother-in-law apartments, more housing? Because I know that's not a universal feeling in Seattle, but is that what I'm hearing?
I didn't say that.
Oh, okay.
I feel like, yes, you can do the backyard cottages. Yes, you can sort of work on this as something to work on. But I believe that people in Seattle love their residential neighborhoods, and they have to be valued.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we can. I suggest we tweet out a very helpful page from the city. Seattle.gov has a page called Regulating Short-Term Rentals, because, you know, you can get into what the actual proposal is. We've been talking about whether it seems effective or even fair to limit the number of Airbnb-type short-term rentals. The stated goal is to put more of these units on the market as long-term rentals for people who live right here in the actual city of Seattle. We're talking about this on the Week in Review. We're going to talk about the gorilla in Cincinnati, and we're going to talk about Donald Trump.
Same sentence.
Okay, and we're going to talk about the real world coming back to Seattle, all coming up in the next few minutes. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review with Melanie McFarlane and Joni Balter and Mike McGinn, and I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. This week, Seattle's Woodland Park Zoo was all set to introduce us to its baby gorilla, but the zoo called off the debut party, saying it was out of respect for their colleagues at the Cincinnati Zoo, where, as I'm sure you know, this happened.
Mommy's right here.
Who's done?
A three-year-old boy climbed into the gorilla enclosure and crawled across the yard and fell down into a moat where the gorilla dragged him around in the water, and the zookeeper shot the gorilla to death. Now, this has been the talk of the nation all week long. If you believe the media, America is outraged at the boy's mother for letting him out of her sight that long, and or outraged at the zoo for shooting the gorilla. First of all, is anyone here outraged at Week in Review? Okay.
No.
I mean, if anything, it's just the thing that I am puzzled about is where this is a no-win situation where it's like, where do you put the blame?
Okay.
So that's a thing. This is a tragedy on all sides.
This is what I'm actually, there's this, to me, a disconnect. Either everyone here is unusually complacent, or the media are, believe it or not, possibly exaggerating the level of fury. And in reality, most people think this was a terribly unfortunate situation all around. So you don't think, I wonder, Melanie, is this a once-in-a-lifetime sort of, you know, never happen again, well, rarely happens tragedy? Or is there anything worth,
know.
Is there an important lesson in any of this?
I think that it's one of those situations where, look, lots of people have problems with zoos in general, but then the people who are actually running zoos and a number of people who are who work with wild animals and actually are conservationists will say, well, what's the best way to get people involved with caring about these conservation efforts? Some would say, like, well, watch them on films. Well, we see plenty of films of all these different animals, but they're not necessarily inspiring people to go and support wildlife conservation. So there's that side. Then there's this whole issue where people are trying to blame the mom and say, you know, that she should have had an eye on her kid. Well, I don't have kids, and one of the reasons I don't have them is because they just run wild no matter, it seems to me. I mean, I have a lot of nieces and nephews.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel for the mother. I think it's one of those things where it goes back to say this is a situation where it's a tragedy on all fronts. And the fact that we will never know what exactly was going to happen with the male gorilla. Jane Goodall sent an email saying it looked like the male gorilla was protecting the boy. And we hear these stories of this has happened in other zoos. And I remember this particular story where there was a primate who a kid got into the enclosure and the primate actually brought the kid over to where the zookeepers come in. So
protecting the child.
Right. So it's just a horrible situation all around. And it's going to happen again, because any time that you have humans in close contact, even in controlled contact with wild animals, you know, there's a certain element of chaos that is always possible.
Joni, is this just a curiosity of the bizarre, or is this about something really important?
Well, yeah. I mean, we're all going to review our behavior, I guess. I feel sorry for everyone in this situation. I don't think it's a reason to get rid of zoos. The nation's becoming more urbanized. We need zoos. And as a mom, I'm on the mom's side with an asterisk. And the asterisk is, yes, no mother that I know of can keep track of a kid every second. My mother, as it turned out, had to put a leash on my brother and because he was super hyper. Now, maybe, I don't know if this kid was or wasn't, I'm not saying, but maybe that's the next step for her. But it is impossible to keep track of it, especially if you have more than one kid every second. And so I don't want to get into blaming the mother. I don't. And I think, you know, they can look at zoo security and see how many little fences he went over and under and all of this. And obviously every zoo should take a look and make sure it's safe.
Joni says something interesting, Mike. We need zoos. Do you buy that?
You know, it's they started in a certain place historically. You know, it was spectacle. It was the unusual. And now the role that they present for themselves within the society is that they help educate people about endangered species and help save them. But, you know, it seems like a lot of the spectacle is still, you know, part of the discussion. So it feels like we're moving in an opposite direction. I mean, I think zoos are facing an uphill fight with the public right now. You look at the elephant issue here in Seattle. And we have such an identity. I mean, that's part of the underlying part of this story, too, is we do identify humans as a species identify with animals. We care about animals and primates in particular. They feel so close to us. And that's why this sparks much greater concern than, say, the plight of, you know, the mountain gorillas in the wild that are endangered. Like, mm-hmm. You can just see it. You can identify. But I'm not in a position where I'm either second guessing the mom or the zookeepers because it's such a crazy situation. But I do think it raises the issue of zoos in general and what's their role in society. And a lot of them are propped up by taxpayers, too, which implicates, you know, City of Seattle, for example. Woodland Park Zoo is owned. That property is owned. It's run separately. And it's they do a tremendous amount of fundraising. They have a lot of donations. But they still come to the city and look for consideration for things.
And over the years, the voters have supported the zoo.
Yeah. So, but that's a debate. I recall Heidi Wills was absolutely, you know, pilloried in the press for saying we should, you know, ban circus animals from Seattle. And now a decade later, she and Judy Nicastro, you know, now a decade later, you know, let's give them some credit. They were ahead of the curve on this one about public attitudes towards how we treat elephants in captivity.
I think it's interesting, though, that you're mentioning, yes, absolutely, in terms of, you know, let's ban circuses that use wild animals. However, there's a difference between a circus and a zoo, a huge one, and there are differences between zoos. I mean, for instance, I grew up in Chicago, and going to Lincoln Park Zoo was very different from going to the zoo that was further outside of town that had more space and where the animals were able to have more, you know, at least mimic a little bit more of their roaming environment and things like that versus in the city where it was, these animals were miserable and you could get really, you know. So, I mean, there's a lot of elements to look at here. There's a lot of things to reassess. But I do think that in terms of just making sure that we are aware of conservation efforts that are being made and that still need to be made, that there, you know, this should hopefully inspire lots of people to look at our relationship with zoos and also our relationship with the places where these animals come from.
I'm not ready to jump to the conclusion Bill suggested about zoos, but it's interesting to watch where it's been going. But one more observation, part of the reason that the zookeepers took the action they did was because of they're concerned that the gorilla was being agitated by the people yelling. And you have to think about the psychological state of that mountain gorilla living in captivity. It's not the same animal when it has to live in those circumstances.
Mm-hmm. And if they're that dangerous, shouldn't zoo animals be behind tall, see-through plexiglass barriers that kids can't climb? So I'm a zoo gorilla, so you're going to put me behind a fence that kids can slip through, and if they slip through, you shoot me.
Yeah,
like, can I just live in the Congo?
So when Melanie was talking, I was thinking, well, it really does sound like there's good zoos and bad zoos, and we should really take a look at the safety. I mean, that's what happens after events like this. You take a look. What is the right setup for that? Those zoo people who made that split-second decision didn't have the luxury of time to decide, well, let's see, is he in a good mood today or not so hot? They just had to go because the tranquilizer, which everyone thought was a better solution, takes longer to take effect.
Right.
And so they had to go quickly. But for the next round of this, there are designed solutions to that that could make it better and make it more like the zoo that you referred to that sounded like it was just a better setup all the way around.
Yeah, it's still a zoo. I mean, it's still going to take enclose a roaming range of any animal that's, you know, makes large treks across, you know, miles and miles. But I mean, and that's the whole thing. It's looking at it and balancing this need to, and you know, Cincinnati Zoo is a conservation zoo. So, I mean, taking a look at these zoos, and if they're saying, okay, if they are part of the effort, then what needs to be done to make sure that people are still getting the education, still having the interest, and still supporting the larger conservationist effort worldwide, and at the same time, we can make sure that this tragedy does not happen again.
Finally, people have been asking whether we should blame the mom. If this had been a father, you know what the reaction would have been? Oh, he took his son to the zoo. It would have been.
So he would have gotten the pass for.
I think
for
being he, I think a dad would have gotten more. Of a pass.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that.
We're bumbling, but it's so adorable bring our child.
Well, but I would defend the father and the mother in that case. You cannot having a perfect track of him.
Having lost a kid in Top 10 Toys and in REI, only briefly. But long enough.
Mike McGinn, aisle 4.
Long enough to have that, you know, when you turn your head and you look for the kid that used to be next to you, and now all you see is aisles and no child, that sinking feeling is unbelievable.
It is unbelievable for a mother or a father.
And I can assure you.
Or an aunt.
And I can assure you that that there's no question. I think I asked the kid to keep it secret from mom, and of course that was not
obviously.
And
not,
you just help. You know, sure.
Yeah, no, there was no sympathy at home. I can assure you of that when I got there. So I'm the challenge you on that one, Bill.
And I'm going to say one more thing in terms of moms doing working as hard as they can to keep an eye on kids. You were talking about, was it your brother or your son who...
That would be my brother with the leash.
With the leash. Yeah. So that's one thing. I think it's one of those things where people are like, well, why didn't, you know, she could have had the kid on a leash. It's like, it seems to me that when people see kids on leashes out in public, then they're like, oh, that poor kid. That mother stinks.
No, it's a safety thing.
So it's just one of those things where it's a catch-22, you know? And again, that's part of the reason, like, I opted out of the whole thing. So
you know who else is in a catch-22? Republican Chris Vance, who we're going to talk to when we turn the page on the Week in Review and the real world back to Seattle, and Mount Rainier competing for bucks and more. Stay tuned. Former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, Civic Cocktails' Joni Balter, Seattle TV writer Melanie McFarland, and I'm Bill Radke, and we are the Week in Review. What is happening to the Never Trump movement? Last month, U.S. Senate candidate Chris Vance, a Republican, said he would not endorse or vote for Donald Trump, and that mattered because Chris Vance was one of many Republicans saying Donald Trump is not who we are. Well, so much for that. Yesterday, the highest-ranking Republican, House Speaker Paul Ryan, folded it up and said, I'll vote for Trump, too. Joining us live, Senate candidate Chris Vance. Hiya, Chris.
How are you doing, guys?
I'm well, thank you. If Paul Ryan were sitting here, what would you say to him?
Well, Paul Ryan, you know, today is blasting Donald Trump for the outrageous things Donald Trump said about the American judge who's presiding over...
not a Mexican judge.
Right. So... I think this is an example of how utterly bizarre this election cycle is. On day one, Paul Ryan reluctantly endorses Donald Trump. Day two, he's blasting him. It's just bizarre.
Why are Republican leaders endorsing a man that they are used to oppose and are still blasting?
I don't know. I wouldn't do it. But I do know. It's when you have to speak for the rest of the party, there is tremendous pressure to unify and to put your own feelings aside and speak for the party. When I was the chairman of the state party, I used to say that my opinions didn't matter. I needed to speak for the Republican Party. So I do understand why Susan Hutchinson and Paul Ryan have to say the things they say, but I don't. I mean, I'm just speaking for myself as an individual.
Is Susan Hutchinson putting party before country?
You're trying to get me in trouble here, aren't you?
Yes.
Well, this is why this is so fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I wouldn't do it. I couldn't do it. But I do understand the pressure. Look, the only thing I'm saying to Republicans is we're going to have to agree to disagree about this. We need to let each other go our own way. We're not going to be united around Donald Trump. There are tons of Republicans who don't support him. There's others who do. That's just the reality of where we are.
Are you in trouble for your position in any way? Did anyone get after you for what you're doing?
Not as an organization. The state party and I have an excellent relationship. Our campaign is fully integrated into what they're doing. But there's a whole lot of individuals who are mad at me, and they love to express that on Facebook and Twitter. And me being on your show is probably going to multiply that.
Is it winning you more votes on balance than losing you, or the other way around?
Among Republicans, it's probably hurting a bit. But I think among independents, it's absolutely vital that you take this position. But that's, Bill, that's not why. To me, this isn't about politics. It's about conscience and principle, and I'm just compelled. I had no choice to say what I said. I don't think you can go through this election and not tell the truth about where you stand on this.
You're also not voting for Clinton, though, right? So isn't that
absolutely not?
Okay, so you're saying that a President Trump or a President Clinton would be equally bad for America?
Yes, and for different reasons.
Equally bad. Okay, tell why.
Well, on the deficit, neither of them has a plan to bring down the deficit and grow our economy. Hillary Clinton used to support free trade. Now she's caving into the unions and opposes TPP. Donald Trump is anti-trade, so they're both wrong on that. Donald Trump would probably appoint better Supreme Court justices from a conservative viewpoint and probably be better on the Second Amendment from a conservative viewpoint. But Hillary Clinton actually has taken more rational positions on foreign policy. She's not the one saying that NATO is obsolete, that Japan should have nuclear weapons and we should torture people. So they're both equally horrendous for different reasons.
What's the worst thing Trump could do?
What's the worst thing? Well,
he's going to say
the worst thing. Well, there's two things for me. I'm a big deficit hawk. I don't think we're going to grow this economy. And yesterday we got the jobs report, or I think it's today, it was horrific. Our economy is in a ditch, and the only way we're going to grow the economy is to bring down our debt. And Donald Trump's proposals would add over $12 trillion to our national debt. I just can't support that. His positions on trade, I just can't support. And his isolationist foreign policy, I think, is incredibly dangerous and could lead to war. When the United States is weak or the United States is absent, that's when small conflicts turn into major wars. So, and you notice a lot of people believe that this is all personal. You know, I'm not talking about his hair or his mannerisms or any of that stuff. I take Donald Trump seriously. I listen to what he says, and I believe he means it. And I just can't support it.
Chris Vance, Republican, running against Patty Murray for the U.S. Senate seat. He has endorsed himself and is asking you to join him in voting for Chris Vance. Chris, thank you for that.
You bet.
Joni, you just moderated a conversation with two top Washington Republicans, head of the party, we mentioned Susan Hutchinson, and former Attorney General Rob McKenna. What did you learn that we should know?
So the point is that this is a big question for Republicans and voters. And years from now, I do believe people will recall this election and say, which side of this question were you on? And at Civic Cocktail, Susan Hutchinson, the leader of the party, has come around and now supports Donald Trump. Rob McKenna, who ran for governor in 2012 and who has a political future, said he can't do it. The guy is not presidential enough, and he can't do it. I spoke this morning with both Dan Evans, the former three-term governor and senator, and former U.S. Senator Slade Gorton, and they're not budging. I thought they might change their position after Paul Ryan changed his, or at least adapted his, to be now for Trump. And so there are Washington Republicans, the leaders of this party, except for Susan Hutchinson, who are unable to get there. They find Donald Trump, this name-calling, this high school stuff, this misogynist stuff, this racist, just goes on and on. They just can't get there. And that's darn interesting if you think about a party. I mean, it has many, many impacts up, down ballot in every which way you can think of.
Mike McGinn, flip the party situation. Can you sympathize with Chris Vance? If there were a populist demagogue, whatever the reasons that I know you're not a Donald Trump fan, so imagine a Democrat who you thought was dangerous. Would you have to go along with the party?
Well, I just have a few observations. One, the state Republican Party has been in divided for a very long time and kind of really struggling with how to be locally, that the division between the conservatives and real deep conservatives and more moderate Republicans has been the story of the Republican Party for a long time here. Second, as for Chris, and I say this with a tremendous amount of respect for the rigors and difficulties of campaigning, but he's getting more media out of this than he's gotten since he announced. I mean, this is not a horrible story for him by any means. I mean, he's gotten almost no coverage before this because he's been perceived as not having the what it takes to beat Patty. So showing some independence is working for him.
And that works in Washington politics. That's something you tend to like.
Yeah. And, as for the Democratic side, I seem to recall I called out a few Democratic leaders in my term as mayor. I'm not sure it worked for me, but that's what I would do. So, you can look it up, Bill.
Look it up. Melanie, you're a media watcher. Are the media having to treat Trump and Clinton as equally credible, even if they don't believe it?
They shouldn't.
Do you think they are? Tell me more.
From what I've been seeing, CNN has just had a holiday with Trump really to, boost their ratings, boost its ratings. And they've taken some heat from that, from media analysts and from consumers.
Why? They're Trump bashing or they're Trump?
They're doing every which way they can, cover Trump. You look at Megyn Kelly over on Fox having this very glowing, almost kind of pal session, masquerading as a one-on-one. There are all these different elements of really using Trump for ratings that goes back to that idea of he was great for TV when he made this franchise of The Apprentice, and now he's making the presidency this franchise. And I think that, there was a point where there were certain large media groups where they were trying, they're at least making some sort of effort or seeming to at being, equal and trying to be hard. But as we're getting closer and closer to the election, it's been very interesting to see that they're going a little bit, it's almost like they're doing their best to play both sides, not to necessarily produce great analysis and, a balanced presentation of each side, but really for the ratings.
Yeah, I wonder whether between the media having to now having to cover a he said, she said, it's down to two, and Paul Ryan, are we normalizing Donald Trump?
Well, that is a huge fear, because what has happened is, on the Republican side, people are coalescing, Paul Ryan, around this candidate, acting as if this behavior is somehow normal, which it's not. I mean, I personally think Donald Trump's a hypnotist. I don't know how he says all these things that he says. He says them over and over. That's the hypnotist angle. And I saw somebody who studied hypnotism interviewed, and there are some of the similar techniques. But anyway,
the repetition.
It's the repetition. Yeah. Over and over again,
and simple words.
Yeah,
the
and
best
simple
words.
Like
he uses the best words.
he uses.
Did you hear how she repeated herself? My eyelids are getting heavy.
but I do. But the only reason I'm saying that is because the things he has done, most candidates would not have their numbers keep going up, their poll numbers. And he does. And it's just so the media is complicit in this. They used to have like the nightly Donald dials in. Hey, whatever you want to say, call in the morning. We'll just take the call whenever it is. Now, Hillary Clinton has started calling in.
Yes.
Just saying somebody must have noticed.
Okay, well, we don't have a Trump fan here. We have talked to them on KUOW. We will continue to, but the news this week is America's top Republican says he's voting for Trump, too. Coming up on the Week in Review, the real world inside a house, the real world outside of the house up on Mount Rainier. Stay tuned. It's the Hey Ho song. Yeah, I do. This is KOW's Week in Review. Mike McGinn, Joni Balter, Melanie McFarlane, and I'm Bill Radke. Real World Seattle is apparently coming back. Who remembers when The Real World came to the waterfront?
Oh, I do.
1998, TV writer Melanie McFarlane, pick me.
Pick me.
This was a huge hit. It was sort of, it was the granddaddy, wasn't it? Like one of the first reality series.
Yeah, this, so The Real World is actually really one of the very, very first reality series and certainly the granddaddy of modern reality. If you are watching The Bachelorette this summer, you may go ahead and say, hey, thanks, Real World.
Thanks, Real World.
Yeah, thanks for that. Also, Big Brother, hey, thank you so much for that. I mean, this was the first one. Before that, it was inspired by a 1973 PBS series called An American Family.
Right. MTV would drop young people into a city and make them live together and roll the camera as the sparks fly.
Right.
And in season 7, 1998, they came to our waterfront, Pier 70, a place there was turned into the Real World house.
This is the true story
of seven people.
Six to live on a pier. Work together.
107.17 and
have their lives taped.
Find out what happens
when people stop being polite.
Start getting real.
The Real World.
Living on a pier, that's so real.
I know. And Seattle stopped getting polite, said, okay, we're going to stop being polite.
Let's talk about that, because it was sort of fun to be on the Real World short list. Remember, it was New York, L.A., like San Francisco, London, Miami, Boston, and us. It was kind of exciting, but Melanie, yeah, I remember Seattleites being really annoyed by the, and being hostile.
It was, so first of all, I should just kind of put this out there. I think the hostility made for a really great story in all of the local publications. I covered it for the Seattle Times, so I'll just say right now, it was a great story. That said, there was some real hostility that they did encounter, and a lot of that is because 1998 was right at the end of the that time right after the grunge era had kind of faded in the national spotlight. So the music scene here had gotten its heyday, and then suddenly it was not the cool hip thing anymore. And so MTV came and went, left, you know, the local music scene high and dry, and then brought back The Real World. So there was a little bit of opportunity for a bit of get back, I think.
Well, even now that there's word that MTV might bring Real World back here, this time to Capitol Hill, one of our major bar and nightclub owners, Dave Minert, told KUOW, these youngsters are not welcome in my clubs.
You know, I think that the producers of the show encourage the kids on the show to act out and kind of act like idiots, get drunk and cause problems because it makes more dramatic TV. And I just don't want people being encouraged to do that in my places.
Mike, Dave Minert's not the only one who wants no part of this reality show, but you said there is, you detect some Seattle hipster condescension in this backlash,
oh,
yes?
Hold it. Here's where I'll go.
Okay.
Here's where I'll go.
Do I read you wrong, sir?
Yes and no. Authenticity is the coin of the realm in this city. Let's just face it. And could there be
Of the generation.
Is there anything more inauthentic than a manufactured TV show calling itself The Real World?
Right.
And so I get it. And also kudos to Dave. He's does a great job of getting media too. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if they even asked him yet to come to his shows. But that's what he's reacting to in part, right? This is just too inauthentic. This is too un-Seattle. But I think we need to be careful because there's a dark side to that mood.
What's the dark side?
The dark side to that mood is, you know, all of this, techies are ruining Seattle. You know, if you want to be angry at the corporate structures that lead to, you know, the policies we have, get angry. But the 25-year-old moving here to program is not the enemy.
So you think they're linked. Part of the Capitol Hill Real World backlash is that's all we need is more newcomers.
Showcasing of it or something.
Fakey.
I think we just need to, you know, not be mean-spirited in reaction to some of these things. And I get it with The Real World. And, you know, I respect Dave for saying that he wants a certain vibe and a certain thing happening in his places. That's his prerogative, and he can go for that. But I do also think that we do have this, hey, you know, we're better than some of the folks who are coming here. And that's a dangerous thing in a city, because there's a lot of people are going to be coming here and a lot more are going to be coming here. And I think we need to not get trapped in that attitude.
Who else thinks we're provincial snobs?
I'm not saying provincial snobs.
Do I misquote you again, man. Sir?
Yes.
That was what I took away.
I don't think it's provincial. You know, I'm not a big fan of this show. I watched a little bit of it. It seemed like a really sour Friends or something. Like, everybody's just like, they're throwing the stuffed animals into the water. I have so much angst. And so the original version of this to me seems like, even if it was late in the grunge era, I think that's sort of more interesting and lends itself to this sort of dark, rainy corner. And then the grunge music that came out of the forests and the mushrooms and all of that.
Oh my.
And this one, I'm just making this up as I go. It's going to have to be about the tech people. And how fascinating is that? They're at their desks. They're either walking at their desks or lifting.
So they're going to be interns at Amazon?
They're still working till 3 in the morning, and their phone rings.
So
it's their boss.
So I have to jump in here. great. However, great imagery. Two things. One, I mean, so when The Real World was here was 1998, it was post-grunge. So that, you know, none of those kids were grunge kids. They were not. They were at the end, and it was a completely different situation. I think
the radio station, the end. They were interning there.
They were interning there. And I think the issue was that it was more a matter of, here were these kids who were living in an inauthentic environment, i.e. not in a neighborhood. They were in a really, really nice 4,500 or something like that square foot place with custom everything at a time in 1998 where their peers in that age group were just scraping to get by. And so when they would encounter these folks out, that's where the heckling would happen. Here, they're in Capitol Hill, and this is where I wanted to address what you were saying, Mike. It's not necessarily hipster, you know, some sort of like hipster kind of posturing here. Realize the Real World's format has changed, and particularly in the last three seasons. The fact that it was the granddaddy of reality shows meant that it also became very passé. And part of the reason that it changed is because of the success of another MTV show, Jersey Shore. And Jersey Shore was a show that was fueled by alcoholic drama, fights, all kinds of things. So the Real World's format has changed. And the most recent one is called Go Big or Go Home. It was set in Vegas. And part of what they did was they had missions they had to complete. And the reward was often what? Getting drunk and partying. So the fact that they're right up in the middle of Capitol Hill, that is great from a production standpoint in terms of they're right around the corner from the Unicorn. They're right by all these places. So they'll be able to party really, really hard. And that, you know, the places like that look great on camera, but they're also very close to the downtown core. So if they want to get down and do something in Pike Place Market and show that for a place, they can do that.
Okay, we're about to wrap it up, Mike. Good Seattleite reacts how to the Real World coming?
Well, first of all, I'll try to be real quick on the responses, which was, I acknowledge all of those points, but I was looking at the darker side, and it wasn't just about hipsters, Bill's phrase, not mine. Because I don't even like that phrase, hipster, because that
I
also...
I love it.
Because we have this way of trying to categorize who's authentic and who's not authentic, and then somehow or another jumping to the inauthentic person is worthy of our scorn. Mm. And I just think, you know, I'm going to get a little earnest here. I just think Seattle's a little bigger and better than that.
And nicer.
And we can look at things in a more nuanced way. So, okay. And the
analogy... So welcome them without judgment.
No.
You're you, I'm me. Hey, no, you're here.
You know,
we can coexist.
I totally get all the concerns about how we're going to be used as a prop for somebody else's entertainment. And I don't like that either. I mean, I just want to be really clear about it. I don't like that either. But I was extrapolating to how we treat lots of other people who come to this town. And the condescension doesn't come just from the hipsters. It comes from lots of people in town saying somehow or another, the place was better right after I got here. It was the best.
Right.
The next person who comes, they're not the right person. And then going to the next level of saying, I'm allowed to be mean to them. And, you know, that's not who we are, is it?
Aww.
That was some reality right
Heart
there,
has
Mike.
Got three sizes bigger.
Yeah.
But I will say in this one, Seattle will probably be the least, will matter the least, I think. It's more about the format.
Right.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Fair enough. Yay, we will matter to the least. To MTV's Real World Seattle, which apparently is coming back here, we think it looks like, to Capitol Hill for their latest season. The Week in Review, we've just been talking about the real world. In a moment, we're going to talk about the natural world.
Oh,
some
yeah.
actual. We're going to bring some more reality into this Week in Review show in a moment. We can't stop talking, and I love that about us. At KOW's Week in Review, Mike McGinn, Joni Balter, Melanie McFarland, and you. Wrapping up the news of the week now, we were just talking about MTV's version of reality. Now comes a Vote Them Off the Island kind of show involving an island, like Alcatraz. Here's the thing. The National Trust for Historic Preservation is holding a contest. Vote your park. 20 parks invited to tell you why they deserve $250,000 for some kind of park project. The public will vote. One of the contestants is Mount Rainier National Park. Now, if you are offended by the very idea of your treasured national park jockeying for reality show bucks, the head of Washington's National Park Fund, Lori Ward, says, get over it. It's the world we live in.
It is what a lot of younger generation, millennials, this is very common to them. So it's going after their social media, their votes, and giving them choices and letting them speak up and say, I love Mount Rainier National Park. I'm going to vote for it. So I think it's wonderful. You know, I don't want to shy away from it because people might perceive it as a contest. It is what it is right now. And this is very common.
Okay, she's on board with the contest, but Mike, does this help our parks or hurt them, having a contest?
Well, it's kind of like the zoo. The contest over the shack lets us know that we are not funding our national parks, but we're not funding our water pipes, we're not funding our roads, we're not funding all sorts of things.
I think we're funding a lot of stuff if you look at how the voters respond to requests for money. We are funding a lot of stuff.
But not near enough to pay for
and
what
not
actually
near
needs
to
be done.
So I think this little method is a little bit hokey, but you know, it's the 100th anniversary of the national parks. The proposal from Mount Rainier is not a bad idea. It helps the search and rescue people.
It's rehabbing a worn out old cabin.
And as we grow, houses
the search and rescue volunteers.
Thank you. And as we grow, you know, more and more people are out in the wild, and some of them are making good decisions, some of them are simply getting caught by weather. But who doesn't want to shout out to the folks who go up there and search and rescue and want them to have a sort of a place to stay that's not awful, considering how they're spending their day and who they're saving? That's pretty darn.
So you don't take the how do we come to this crass, you know, go beg for America's money.
It's not that much.
Well, we are marching towards Idiocracy, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, please rent that movie and then be amazed. But I do think that there's something to be said for actually channeling social media and actually getting, you know, the social media and younger generations excited about national parks and excited about public spaces. I think that here in the Northwest, we may take it for granted that we can wake up every day and look, you know, go down a street and probably see one of the most beautiful views that anyone could see with a mountain. You know, we can drive just a little while and go to a beautiful forest. I grew up in Chicago. We had the Dan Ryan Woods. And that was not a whole lot. That's probably not on there. So
my point
being, if this is something, we can't just rely on Ken Burns doing something on, you know, National Parks, America's Greatest Idea, because kids are not going to watch that. Younger people are not going to watch that. But it may be really cool to actually, at least, you know, even if it doesn't necessarily get any kind of huge uptake in terms of younger people, at least make people aware that, you know, a contest like this could be really, really fun and actually kind of educational. And you're not going to see Mount Rainier or the cabin get put into a back of a limo and sent home and crying like, I really thought.
So the last I checked, Yosemite and Yellowstone and Grand Canyon were beating Mount Rainier. But how are we going to compete against Yosemite and Yellowstone and Grand Canyon?
Yeah, but wasn't there enough money? It sounded like for about 10 parks. And it seemed like we could somehow...
And maybe they'll say, we decided to fund them all.
Also, are we beating Alcatraz?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. The nearest one to us, the nearest park to us is Alcatraz Island, and they want to restore their guardhouse to its 1920s appearance. I was there a week ago.
How was the appearance?
It was fine. You're not there for the guardhouse.
Right.
You want to go to the solitary confinement cell. You want to see the bars that got pried open. You want to see the fake head that Clint Eastwood put in his cot.
You do.
To escape.
I wanted to see Sausalito.
Why am I here? Why am I not in Sausalito?
Yeah.
Where it's it was. I was in both.
Yeah.
And it was sunnier in Sausalito than it was inside the solitary.
My in-laws chose Alcatraz.
Did they? And dragged you along?
Yes.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Al Capone didn't want to come here, and neither do I. But we are beating we're beating Mount Rushmore so far.
All right. I think we're going to do it.
Think
do
so?
It. Yeah, I do.
Well, see, this is the thing. What you start to get sucked in. Like,
you know how many times I've been calling that number and emailing since we've been talking about
really? This? You're jamming the ballot box?
Jamming it.
You know what?
That's
National Mall.
Way, thank you.
What's that?
I said, that's a Chicago way. Thank you.
That's very Chicago.
That's what they do.
We're voting for a dead national park. The National Mall in D.C. wants to restore the Christopher Columbus Fountain. Can I vote to take money away from a national park project? With that?
You can start a petition on change.org. That'll do it, I think.
That will do it. All right. That's the Vote Your Park. Yeah, you can vote on that. You can vote for Mount Rainier if you want to voteyourpark.org, hashtag Vote Your Park. The voting closes July 5th. Mount Rainier, one of 20 national parks appealing for funds. You know what Mount Rainier these days is when it's 91 degrees on Sunday, is all of that, how much of that snow is just going to disappear? How much of our beautiful snowpack is going to be gone?
It's heading out. We're heading to 90 this weekend.
You're disturbed, Mike, by the heat.
I am super disturbed by the heat.
You can't just enjoy it.
No, I can't.
This is like our third heat wave since April, is that right?
I think the data is that, you know, nobody alive has lived in a warmer world. I mean, we're setting new records all the time. And
so you cannot enjoy hot, sunny weather. Like, I'm going to Fort Worden State Park this weekend. I got my sunscreen. Like, I can put off climate change worry for a couple of days.
And some beefsteak tomatoes.
That's one of the reasons why people aren't alarmed by climate change, because in some cases, it's a little bit of better weather.
It just reminds me of, and my daughter gave this to me, it just reminds me of Game of Thrones, man. Everybody's like talking about all this stuff, man. The White Walkers are north of the wall here, and it's about time we started paying attention. It's time we started paying attention to the big global threat and you know, doing something about it. And it's happening right here, right now in front of us, Bill.
Your former Seattle mayor saying, don't just enjoy the sun this weekend, do something about it. The heat, I should say. Mike McGinn, host of You...
Me.
Us.
Now.
The podcast. Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. You'll find Melanie McFarland's writing at mctelevisionblog.com. She's a Seattle TV writer and one of our favorites. It's great to see you all.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
On the Week in Review. Thanks.